My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We hope you'll stay tuned. And we are joined by Bob Brown of the Labor Party. Mr. Brown, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Mike.
Well, we appreciate that you were able to be with us. Can you let the listeners know about the Labor Party, what you all are about, and how you came into existence, and then we can begin to talk about some of the specifics that the Labor Party is standing for and trying to get accomplished?
Sure. 1996 in June was the actual founding convention where 1,350-some-odd delegates from unions and worker supportive organizations from around the country, from actually 48 states, including Alaska, embarked on Cleveland, Ohio, and put into motion an organization, a political party, non-electoral at that stage and continues to be at this stage non-electoral, to address issues that were of concern and were in the particular self-interest of working and poor people. That came as an effort probably 6 to 7 years prior out of what was then the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union and their delegates to a convention in 1989 who asked their union to pursue other unions as well as other organizations around the country around the idea of the need for an alternative political party. That 6-7 year period resulted in that founding convention in June when it was seen that there was enough interest amongst working class organizations and organizations of the poor to begin to develop such a model.
One of the things that makes the Labor Party, I think, very, very unique, I mean, there are many things that make the Labor Party unique. The fact that there is a Labor Party is unique in this country, right?
Yes, it is. I mean, unlike Western Europe, this country basically found through the mid-1930s through the 60s, the Democratic Party as a vehicle to more or less express working people's concerns. However, that political party was then, and even more so now, dominated by corporate interests, and that became more evident and clear as the 1960s, 70s, began to watch the Democratic Party desert any and all forms of interest and organization around working class issues. So.
Talk, if you will, about why you make that statement that the Democratic Party has deserted working people.
Well, I mean, it's become pretty clear to most people who labor for a living or who, in fact, have been thrown out of the labor market that the Democratic Party doesn't even use the word labor union anymore. At its last convention, it wasn't in any one of its convention planks, the word labor union, or union for that matter. The corporations and the concentration of wealth that is occurring through globalization has made those who run for political office in a two-party system of electoral politics beholden to those who have the money and the wherewithal to give candidates exposure through the electronic media by which people get elected. And that's dominated by corporate interests, and those who choose to run as either Republicans or Democrats are beholden to those interests that make it possible for them to run and in some cases succeed in getting elected.
Certainly with the way elections are structured here in the U.S. and the vast amounts of money that it takes for anyone to be elected to almost any office. I mean, this huge influx of campaign cash is now working its way down farther and farther down to local politics all the time. That, as you so stated, I mean, that both of these so-called political parties, which are supposed to allegedly represent two ends of a spectrum, are increasingly just representing different faces of the same people they serve. I mean, that's what you're saying, right?
That's right. I mean, one barks and acts and attacks like a dog, and the other one might not bark like a dog, but certainly attacks and bites like a dog.
Well, there are a lot of people who say Bill Clinton has been the best Republican president the Republicans ever had.
Oh, yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, Bill Clinton is a product of a move in the Democratic Party after the serious defeat of, who was it, Mondale, in his efforts?
Yes.
Of the development of the Democratic, Southern Democratic, where it was actually the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which was a pretty much a Southern-based Democratic Party coalition that then found its tentacles throughout the country as a move to the right of the Democratic Party and really into the coffers of New York City financial wing of Capitol. That basically said, we own the Democratic Party, and they do, and they own the Republican Party, and the interests of the little guy out here, myself included, have been just lost on the scene. I mean, not even spoken to. I mean, from the late 60s until probably the mid-80s, there was lip service paid to working people, their concerns, nothing ever delivered. But some, you know, diminishing lip service over that 15-year period. And to the point that by the mid-'80s, late-'80s, the Democratic Party saw, in a very conscious effort, no good reason to even pay lip service, much less not do anything as they had been doing from the mid to late 60s onward.
We're talking with Bob Brown of the Labor Party. Mr. Brown, let me ask you, because another, I think, very, very powerful and unique aspect of the Labor Party has been its position, if you will, or its goal to bring together both working people and those people who have been pushed out of work, people who are not working. And I think that that's a tremendously unique perspective for a political party and, in many cases, you know, for unions to embrace people who are not working. So often there's been this thing, well, we're working, they're not, so forget them. The Labor Party has really been strong in its efforts to include those people who are increasingly being more and more marginalized in the political process. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, the Labor Party and the union base out of which it was founded is a section. It's not the entirety of the labor union movement. But a section of the labor union movement, including seven international unions, who, you know, have come to understand that without the kind of political unity that represents their members who are losing their jobs either by downsizing, plant closings, some form of permanent layoff, whether by attrition or otherwise, but a constantly deteriorating standard of living or a constant battle just to maintain what one has, that their very members who are in the plant one day and out of the plant the next are still the very same people, and that an organizational and educational center for politics needs to embrace both those still currently working who may not be working tomorrow and those who yesterday were laid off. It's really a class-based party with a class perspective that's talking about its self-interest as a class of people who increasingly have little, infinitely little, or no say at all in the political process. And it's really about becoming the political organizing and educational center for those class interests at this stage of our development.
You bring up two very, very interesting and I think important topics that I'd like to explore a little bit further. One is that the attacks on poorer people, welfare reform, quote-unquote, and or other things, actually undermine the base for which many, many people who are working, perhaps at the lower ends of the pay scale, I mean, these attacks on, you know, quote-unquote welfare recipients actually are attacks on low-wage workers, because what they do is they undermine the entire wage base, whereby employers can, you know, say, well, guess what? You either work for a dollar an hour or less, or hit the street and there's nothing out there for you. You'll be homeless and you'll be starving. So give up these benefits or do this or do that, because it's either this or nothing. I mean, people don't really understand that, I think. And I mean, would you agree with that statement that I'm making?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, wholeheartedly. It's any time that you attack the bottom of any structure, you lower the entire structure. I mean, it's like taking, cutting off a rung of a ladder. The ladder gets shorter, everything moves down.
Right.
Even the higher-end wage workers ultimately are affected. What welfare reform, as signed by Bill Clinton in August of 1996, represented was a wholesale dismantling of a social security in this country that essentially is forcing labor at the bottom end to pull everything down. And it's all in the name of remaining globally competitive in the whipsawing of wages of one country versus another. The U.S., in order to try and attract investment both domestically and internationally here in this country for goods and services produced in this country, needs to ratchet down its wage standards to the lowest common denominator. So it's kind of a race to the bottom globally in terms of working people to increase and maximize at an accelerated rate the profits of those who own.
In countries other than the United States, we often hear these programs referred to, I think, as structural adjustment. Here it's called welfare reform, I think, is what we're saying.
Oh, absolutely. And unlike Western Europe, where labor parties, if you will, social democratic type parties, if you will, where they exist, those countries, the financial and corporate interests have had a good deal tougher time in the implementation of the ratcheting down of wage scales and social programs, because they've been part of the political fabric of working people. They achieved it through real political struggle, through political parties in Western European and Scandinavian countries. So they are not as far advanced in the dismantling of their social programs and wage structures as the United States is. We never had such a political party here. So our working folks have been at a loss to be able to rally and organize a resistance to those moves. And we saw how easy welfare reform was just pushed through. And it was pushed through by a Democratic president. In fact, if George Bush had attempted to sign welfare reform, there would have been a hue and cry, and it probably would not have been signed.
Well, certainly, and going back to the point that Bill Clinton has gotten away with pushing some of the most Republican of Republican agendas, or at least traditionally Republican agendas, through, when George Bush, as you so stated, would have probably never been able to get those through. We're talking with Bob Brown of the Labor Party. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. Mr. Brown, you brought up another topic in your last discussion, and that was the topic of class, the issue of class. And most people are really, really afraid to even discuss this. Can you talk a little bit more about the class aspects of what we're talking about here?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's a reluctance on the part of many to talk in class terms simply because there's been a very widespread propaganda that is almost been tantamount to, if you speak in those terms, you must be some kind of lunatic fringe or a red or somebody who wants to subvert the good old American way. Well, class has always been with us. And in fact, it was a very common term to use in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in this country. We saw an expansion of the economy in the 50s and 60s and early part of the 1970s, where most working people were fed that widespread propaganda that they were not working class anymore, that they were now middle class. And now all of a sudden there were distinctions between those who were poor, who were unworking and unemployed, poor who were working, and then, of course, those who were working and making a decent wage, who were not working class anymore, they were middle class. And then there was the upper middle class. And all these contrived subgroupings and classes for people to think of themselves as. Well, we've lived with, really, almost 40 years of that, those connotations. So to bring back what was common to American working people in the 30s and 40s and early part of the 50s, and that was to know of themselves, as if you worked for somebody else, you had no doubt as to where you fell. You were working for somebody else. They owned you for the time that you worked for them. You got a wage from them. If that wage was enough to allow you and your family to survive, then you did. If it wasn't enough, you struggled to try and make it that. But you were a working class person, unless you owned or you became an agent of those who owned. Well, that got lost in that 30 to 40 year period. However, more and more people are coming to understand their economic position in society. And those who are working are, and in the Labor Party, we refer to it all the time, and folks who maybe never used the term working class in their entire life of 30, 40 years are now beginning to understand conceptually what that means. If they're working for a living, or even if they've been thrown out of the work process, but that's all they've got by which to survive is their ability to go work, they consider themselves as working class folks. And that's why I say an organizational or political organizational and educational center is what's necessary, and that's what the Labor Party at this stage of its development hopes to be.
We're talking with Bob Brown of the Labor Party. Mr. Brown, let me ask you, there are a couple of specifics going on and that have been going on with the Labor Party that I'd like us to get to. One of them is, I believe it's the 28th Amendment, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Can you talk about that? Because when I first heard about that, I guess it's been a couple of years or so ago now, I mean, the concept of this is tremendous, and probably most people haven't really heard of it.
Well, our program of the Labor Party is a 16-point program. The first programmatic point is, oh, and the program itself, I mean, coming out of that founding convention in 1996, was to not compromise with what our self-interest as working or unemployed people is. I mean, our self-interest is real, and we needed to be bold in defining what our self-interest was, and then in once having defined it, we needed to be bold in finding those correctives to the situation that we find ourselves in representing those self-interests. And the first programmatic point of our party program is to amend the Constitution to guarantee everyone a job at a living wage. That is what is called, or commonly referred to now, as the 28th Amendment campaign, to amend the Constitution with a 28th Amendment to guarantee every resident of this country a job, and a job that pays $10 an hour indexed to inflation as a minimum at 1996 wage rates, and that if a job cannot be guaranteed, that our government is responsible. It's our government, not somebody else's, that in order to live in this country, the bare minimum necessary by which to exist and to raise oneself and family, small family, I might add, requires a minimum of wages accordingly. And if the government cannot guarantee that job, then it must pay its equivalent.
Certainly, I mean, to me, that's it's a tremendously good thing. I'm just sitting here thinking about all of these people who, you know, jump up and down and scream and yell about amending the Constitution to keep people from burning flags or whatever, and they're willing to have a constitutional convention to deal with that. I'm not going to argue with them about it. But, you know, here we have a proposal, and you know, to declare that it's a constitutional right of the people of this country to be able to work and have a living wage. And I don't hear these people out screaming, jumping up and down, saying we need to have a constitutional convention for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
I agree. I mean, the point in the program that speaks to the 28th Amendment campaign. And I'll just read it to you. First and foremost, everyone, both in private and public sectors, needs a guarantee of a right to a job at a living wage, one that pays above poverty level wages and is indexed to inflation. And in today's world, that comes to a minimum of about $10 an hour. That was in 1996. All this says is we as American people, the 250 million of us that there are, or thereabouts, need to assert our rights in a constantly narrowing political field where our rights are expressed. And unless we take the initiative in expressing those rights and making those demands and organizing ourselves to be effective in exercising those rights, then we are going to continue to lose, and we are going to continue to be dominated by that narrowing political field that is constantly being absorbed by corporate interests, those whose profit and maximization of that profit at an accelerated rate comes at our expense.
We're talking with Bob Brown of the Labor Party. Mr. Brown, I also know that the Labor Party has a major health care initiative that is being kicked off. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Talk, if you will, about that, please.
On June 6th, this Sunday, we will kick off nationwide a radio broadcast, and simultaneous with that broadcast, our Just Healthcare campaign, a campaign that is organized nationwide to begin to change the nature of the debate as it presently exists around the government's responsibility to provide health care, I mean, a right that we've come to think of as not a right anymore, that government no longer has the responsibility to ensure that people not die. We are launching this campaign to begin to change that debate, to begin to organize, educate, and mobilize people to begin to act in their self-interest and to begin to start talking to their family, neighbors, friends, coworkers, and begin to make a stir in this country around the government's responsibility to ensure that health care is provided to every resident of this country. And to do so means to take those who are profiting from health care, namely the insurance companies, out of the equation, that our country can provide health care to every resident in this country.
And in part, the catalyst for beginning this debate on a national level is going to be this radio program you talked about.
This radio program is going to be 20-some-odd stations around the country, public radio, that will be part of a live two-hour program. Will air this Sunday, June 6th, from 12 noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and each one of the time zone equivalents to that, as a live broadcast, a panel of healthcare professionals and others who have been dealing with national healthcare will be discussing the state of healthcare in America today during the first hour segment. And then the second hour segment, listeners nationwide will be calling in to ask questions or make statements or carry on a discourse with those panel members to conclude the two-hour program.
As I understand it from what you were saying, this is going to be available on satellite through public radio outlets. And in talking to some of our technical people here, apparently KVMR does not have access to that satellite, as I understand it. But certainly, I believe National Public Radio does. And were you telling me that you didn't think the Sacramento NPR station was going to be broadcasting that, or did you know?
The call letters of that station is?
We have KXPR and KXJZ, and they are located in Sacramento. They are actually in the same building.
No.
They are not.
They are not on the list. They were sent materials. They were followed up with phone calls. I did not have the specific responsibility for those stations, but I know that they were on the list and that someone did, and we have not heard that they will be broadcasting live that day.
Well, certainly it would seem to me that if KXPR and KXJZ were truly public radio and wanted to truly serve the public, this would be a real opportunity for them to bring forth probably one of the most important public debates facing our country and our times. I think you would agree on that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's an opportunity for them to do what public radio is thought mandated to do, and that is to bring these kind of questions out to the public at large and allow the public to participate in the debate. So I'm hopeful that both stations will, at some point or another, between now and Sunday, find the wherewithal to pull down off the public radio satellite system this live broadcast, which will air Pacific time on Sunday, June 6th, from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m.
We've been speaking with Bob Brown of the Labor Party. Mr. Brown, we just have a minute left. A final thought for our audience, and also how could they get a hold of the Labor Party if they wanted to do that?
All right. The Labor Party can be reached at P.O. Box 53177, Washington, D.C., zip code 20009, and telephone number is 202-234-5190, and the fax number is 202-234-5266.
And can you give the phone number one more time while people are scrambling for pens and paper?
Absolutely. Telephone number 202-234-5190, and that is the national headquarters of the Labor Party in Washington, D.C.
And a brief final thought for our audience?
A brief final thought is that if people in your listening audience feel that everything in the world can go along and get along as it is, then probably the Labor Party is not for them. However, if any of your listening audience thinks that there's changes that need to be made in the interests of everyday, ordinary American people working and or presently unemployed, then they need to find the kind of organization that the Labor Party is in order to make a contribution and not wait for somebody else to do it for them, but to take the initiative and join up with others who are about trying to make real change in this country in the interests of everyday, ordinary American people.
Bob Brown of the Labor Party, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Mike.
That's it for this edition of the program. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. If you're interested in copies of this or other Full Logic Reverse programs, you can contact us via email at flr@jps.net or by telephone at area code 530-265-9462. Full Logic Reverse is produced at FLR Studios in Nevada City, California, USA. Our music is by Rick Payne. We hope you'll join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.